It was a warm, sunny day in the summer of 2016 when a 20-year-old called Alex Henry and three of his friends decided to go shopping in Ealing Broadway, West London. At some point during the day, the group split up in two. But as Alex browsed the shops, some of his friends became involved in a confrontation outside with a group of strangers. What was perceived as a disrespectful look sparked hostility between one of Alex's friends and a 21-year-old man called Taki Kaziki. This quickly turned into violence.
I don't understand, and I don't think I'll ever understand how something so insignificant would set those wheels in motion.
That's Charlotte Henry, Alex's older sister.
It's just too much of an injustice. I can't let it go.
As the standoff continues, Alex is seen on CCTV, shopping with his friend Cameron. When they eventually decide to leave, they stroll leisurely out of the shopping centre. Charlotte says they were unaware of what they were about to witness.
And you could suddenly see my brother and Cameron break into a run. And they run down the road, and as they approach the scene, the violence erupts.
A punch, a headlock, the lash of a belt, another punch, and then it was over in less than a minute.
My brother grabs Janelle and begins running back to the shopping centre. He's pursued for a short time by Borhain and Taki Kaziki. But then you see that Taki abruptly stops. He has his hand on his hip. And sorry, I get a bit emotional talking about it because I could just picture it. He puts his hand on his hip and then he's obviously quite unwell.
Very soon after that, Taki Kaziki, who was a 21-year-old aspiring accountant, died from a stab wound. According to Charlotte, what Alex didn't know at the time was that one of his friends had used a concealed knife to stab the young man during the confrontation. That friend's name was Cameron Ferguson. Alex had known him for less than a year. Despite being the only one to wield the knife, Cameron Ferguson was not the only one to pay the price for killing Taki Kaziki. Both Alex and his friend Janelle would also be later found guilty of his murder.
I couldn't understand how Alex's conduct could have ever intentionally encouraged or assisted a murder.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. Because the alternative is just too awful to imagine. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Overturn. Today I'm in Guildford to find out more about the case of Alex Henry.
My name is Charlotte Henry. I'm the sister of Alex Henry, who in 2014 was convicted of murder under joint enterprise.
Charlotte tells me that she and Alex were close as children, despite being total opposites.
I'm quite bubbly. I found it very easy to make friends. I'm very untidy. And I talk back a lot. I used to talk back a lot to our parents. I describe him as quite shy. He found it difficult to make friends. His developmental stages were slightly behind me. I always found myself speaking for him, which I suppose you get with a lot of older siblings to younger siblings. He used to have these awful meltdowns as a child. he was bullied quite badly in primary school. And so I used to kind of, when my school finished slightly earlier, I would leave and then go to his school and confront his bullies.
After school finished, Alex struggled a bit to find his feet. But in 2013, he had started working as a carpenter with their dad.
He was doing a lot better. There was quite a long period of time that he wasn't doing much of anything. So we were really kind of proud that he had started going to work with my dad and was kind of looking positively towards the future. He had a girlfriend as well. He was trying to really get his act together.
That was until Tuesday, the 6th of August, 2013. The day that changed Alex's life forever.
My brother was out shopping with three friends, Janelle Grant-Murray, Cameron Ferguson and Eunice Taib.
At one point during the day, Alex's friend Eunice got bored of shopping and told the group that he was going to buy some cannabis from a friend around the corner. He lived very close by, so agreed with Alex, Janelle and Cameron that they were going to come and knock at his door when they had finished shopping and that they would all go to hang out in the park. Shortly after, Janelle left too.
So Janelle leaves Alex and Cameron shopping and he walks up towards Eunice's address. And as he's walking down the road of that address, he encounters a group of four older men. He starts to believe that they were looking at him. So kind of looks were exchanged, which were quite threatening and aggressive. And so Janelle turned around and began to walk back to the shopping centre. And CCTV captures this. So you see Janelle look over his shoulder and notice that he's being followed by the group. He then breaks into a run and looks over his shoulder again and can see that they're also running. They are now chasing him. I don't understand and I don't think I'll ever understand how something so insignificant would set those wheels in motion, but they were strangers to each other. They didn't know each other. And this wasn't, you know, a case of gang members bumping into each other in the street. Neither groups were gang members.
As Janelle reaches the corner, Eunice arrives on the scene. Janelle had called for reinforcements. He was allegedly heard on the phone telling someone to bring knives. Records show that he did call a friend, but he denied asking for weapons to be brought to the scene.
Janelle runs into a local cost cutter and grabs a bottle of wine. He exits the cost cutter and he brandishes the bottle of wine at his side as a weapon. In retaliation, Borhain and Taki Kaziki, their brothers, they take off their belts and they begin to kind of lasso them in whipping motions and they wrap them around their fists to use as knuckle dusters. And this is all captured on CCTV. It was all available for the jury to see.
When Alex and Cameron left the shop, they spotted Janelle in trouble and ran to help.
And you could suddenly see my brother and Cameron break into a run. And they run down the road. And as they approach the scene, the violence erupts around my brother. Oladapo Tajani, one of the victims' group, pulled the bottle of wine from Janelle's hand. Taki launches at Janelle and begins to punch Janelle. My brother sees Janelle's mobile phone has fallen out of his pocket. He picks that up and he throws it at Taki's face. Simultaneously, Cameron has approached Borhain. Borhain has hit Cameron with the belt. Eunice has taken Borhain into a headlock. And Cameron Ferguson has stabbed Borhain at that moment in his back.
No one saw the wound. In fact, at this moment, the victim didn't even realise he had been stabbed.
He can only pinpoint that must have been when it happened because he did feel what he would describe as a blow to his back. Cameron then made his way over to Taki Kaziki, who was punching Janelle at the time and stabbed Taki in the back. It went through his lung and through his aorta.
The violence Charlotte describes lasted less than 47 seconds. We know that because it's caught on CCTV. In that time, Alex had thrown a mobile phone and punched one of the boys.
My brother grabs Janelle and begins running back to the shopping centre. He's pursued for a short time by Borhain and Taki Kaziki, but then you see that Taki abruptly stops. He has his hand on his hip, and sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional talking about it because I could just picture it. He puts his hand on his hip, and then he's obviously quite unwell. And that's when that footage was, a member of the public had begun filming it. And yeah, very quickly afterwards, he dies.
The young men end up going to a youth centre, which Charlotte says was a part of the original plan. It's there that Cameron confesses to the group that he has stabbed two people.
At that moment, Alex goes into hiding because little did we know his girlfriend was pregnant. She was 12 weeks pregnant, and the scan was on the Friday and this had taken place on the Tuesday. So my brother wanted to lie low in order to be able to go to his girlfriend's scan on the Friday. I knew nothing about what had happened until the next day when I was at work. And my brother called me and he said, Charlotte, I need you to do something for me. Something really bad has happened. So what I need you to do on Friday is I need you to pick me up. I need you to pick my girlfriend up. And by the way, my girlfriend's pregnant. So you need to take me to the pregnancy scan. And then I need you to take me to the police station. And so I wanted to know what had happened. So what's happened? He was very adamant he wouldn't tell me. I said, I can't tell you because I need you to do this for me. In hindsight, he was protecting me because that would be assisting an offender had I had known that he had committed an offence. So I think he never actually had this conversation with him before, but presumably he was trying to protect me. And I never got to know from him because on the Thursday night, he was traced to Croydon, where he had been hiding out, and he was arrested for murder and attempted murder.
And what about your life? What did it look like at that time?
I just finished my law degree. So I had a law degree from Brunel University, and I was working as an administrator at London Probation Trust with offenders.
Despite having knowledge of the legal system, Charlotte couldn't understand how Alex could be charged with murder when he hadn't wielded the knife. She was aware of the concept of joint enterprise, where more than one defendant can be convicted on the same offence in relation to the same incident, despite differing levels of involvement. But the evidence in Alex's case did not support the prerequisites for joint enterprise. Traditionally, the prosecution must prove that the accessory, in this case Alex, intentionally encouraged the offence. But Alex had just been present.
What did you expect to happen at that point going forward then?
So I thought maybe it was about going through the motions. So whilst Alex hadn't been labelled as a stabber, no one had been labelled as a stabber. They didn't know who had actually done it. You could kind of see that it was Cameron by some of the evidence, but I suppose I thought that it just needed to go before a jury and the jury needed to decide who it was that inflicted the fatal injuries and then look to see whether there was any evidence that any of the others participated. But we knew that there wasn't. And so at that point, Alex would be acquitted. I had a lot of hope at that time that justice would be done.
In 1984, a court ruling established a new legal principle. It allowed a person to be prosecuted for an offence committed by another if they participated in a lesser offence and foresaw the possibility that the other person might commit the more serious offence. In other words, as Alex participated in the fight, and assuming that he could predict that his friend was going to stab and kill Taki Kaziki, then under this law, he too was guilty of the murder. He didn't need to intentionally participate in the offence. The law has attracted fierce criticism in the past because of its disproportionate application to Black and minority ethnic people.
What was the prosecution's case against Alex?
At the time that my brother was at trial, Alex could be guilty of an offence if he participated in one crime while foreseeing the possibility that a second crime might happen. So if he participated in a fight while knowing his friend was in possession of the knife and therefore foresaw the use of that knife, he could be convicted of murder. that was the law at the time. And so the prosecution's narrative was to obviously demonstrate my brother's participation in a fight. Well, yes, Alex was a participant in a fight. We would say he acted in self-defense, but the prosecution's case was that it wasn't self-defense, it was a fight. And then the prosecution had to prove that Alex knew Cameron had a knife.
As you might imagine, it's quite difficult to prove that someone knows or predicted something. What's more, Cameron Ferguson had pleaded guilty to wielding the knife. Charlotte and her family believed that her brother would come home. According to the defense, there was no evidence that Alex knew Cameron had a knife, and therefore no evidence that he could foresee a knife might be used. But their hope was soon extinguished. In their closing speech to the jury, the prosecution said, "Friends tell each other everything."
And therefore, if friends tell each other everything, you can be sure that Cameron told Alex that he had a knife during the course of the shopping trip. And therefore, when Alex participated in the fight, he did so with the knowledge that Cameron Ferguson possessed a knife and the foresight that that knife might be used. And the jury believed that.
Alex was found guilty. And on the 12th of March 2014, he became a convicted murderer. Approximately 2 weeks later, he was sentenced to life with a mandatory minimum term of 19 years imprisonment.
We were there throughout trial. It was a 6 week trial and I was there every day and at the verdict and at sentence. It was physically and emotionally exhausting. I was very, very kind of anxious and depressed going through the whole thing. So after Alex's conviction, my depression just got obviously so much worse. And I was put on kind of different antidepressants and sleeping tablets and diazepam to kind of calm myself in the day. But it resulted in me getting diagnosed with psychosis. So I began to kind of have visual hallucinations. And even when I went back to work, I started working at victim support in the August. So I think I had probably about 5 months off and was working at victim support, and I was still having visual hallucinations and trying to hide it from my clients. But no one knew.
How did you get through that time?
So the campaigning was, it saved my life, really. So from the moment Alex was charged, I joined the campaign group Jengba. Jengba stands for the Joint Enterprise Not Guilty by Association. Jengba is a grassroots campaign founded in 2010 by Gloria Morrison and Janet Cunliffe. Gloria Morrison, the campaign coordinator, said that I must harness my anger.
It was clear to Charlotte that at some point the government legal aid funding would run out for Alex and the family would not be able to afford new representation. So she did the obvious thing. She became a lawyer. For the next year, Charlotte's life consisted of campaigning, studying and working. Alongside Jengba, she campaigned to abolish the new form of joint enterprise, the one which Alex had been convicted under. The campaign was successful and the law was abolished. Charlotte hoped that Alex could appeal his conviction based on this change in the law. So in June 2017, Alex applied for appeal on two counts. One, that the joint enterprise law he had been convicted under had been abolished. And number two, that he had recently received an autism diagnosis.
I had a website dedicated to exonerating Alex with an email address. And I received an email one day by a member of the public who said, from the way I described him, have I ever considered that Alex might be autistic? And if he is autistic, that could have, you know, significant help in Alex's appeal. And I saw it and we kind of spoke back and forth, me and this member of the public, but I really didn't think he was autistic. I didn't understand autism enough as what I do today. I thought if you're autistic, you don't have empathy. And because of how close I am with my brother, I know he's got really strong empathy. So I thought, no, he can't be. And it was a couple of months later at Christmas, my mum was saying, oh, I really wish Alex was assessed before trial. You know, I've always been worried that Alex has got something wrong with him and that wasn't considered by the court. And I said, oh, funny enough, you should say that. Look at these emails. And that was just like red rag to a bull. My mum now was going to get him assessed for autism. And she contacted a number of experts, but because we didn't have legal aid at the time, we couldn't instruct them. And in the end, she contacted Professor Baron Cohen, who was head of the National Autistic Society and world-leading expert, like the best in the world. And he agreed to visit Alex and assess him for autism pro bono. He gave evidence to the Court of Appeal. And he basically says that Alex's autism means that he has a theory of mind impairment. That means Alex struggles with understanding the emotions and intentions of other people, especially in fast-moving situations where there is no verbal dialogue. So these kind of understanding what someone else is thinking and feeling by their facial expressions and body movements. And he can't predict their behaviors or would really struggle to predict their behaviors.
The professor says Alex's autism would make it incredibly difficult for him to foresee the possibility that Cameron Ferguson would stab the victim and intend to kill or cause that victim very serious bodily harm, especially given the encounter was just 47 seconds in length. It was fast moving. It was between strangers and it was spontaneous. This, the professor argues, makes it highly unlikely that Alex is guilty. The psychologist likened his case to convicting someone for walking into a wall and then realizing they were blind. But the appeal was unsuccessful. Although Cengiz's campaign to change the law had worked, the courts were not applying it retroactively to cases. What's more, they didn't believe in Alex's autism diagnosis.
The Lord Chief Justice of the Court of Appeal, one of the most senior lawyers in England, had turned around and says, no, world-leading expert, you are incorrect. Firstly, I don't believe that Alex even has autism. And secondly, I don't believe autistic people have the issues that you've identified. That's ridiculous. I can't put it into words.
The problem was that between the ages of 9 and 14, Alex had had several previous mental health assessments. There were behavioural issues growing up, which Charlotte attributes to his autism, which led to him being expelled from school at age 11.
And so he had these 7 mental health assessments that weren't looking for autism because it was the 90s and autism wasn't particularly on the map at that point, mild autism. And so they didn't identify autism, not that they were looking at autism. And so the Court of Appeals said, why is Professor Baron Cohen correct when those previous 7 child psychologists never identified autism? And so that was the reason that they gave, the only reason for refusing his appeal against conviction.
Since his rejected appeal, Alex has had one unsuccessful application to the Criminal Case Review Commission, the only independent body with the ability to refer cases back to the Court of Appeal.
The CCRC aren't proactive at all, and they really hide behind the current legislation. So they won't give their own opinion about a case because they don't have to. It's a predictive test. So if there's a real possibility that the Court of Appeal will overturn a conviction, that's when they'll refer it. That's how they can kind of hide behind what the Court of Appeal might do. So if the Court of Appeal are making unjust decisions, they'll also make an unjust decision rather than saying that on the bare bones of it, this should go through. So I think that's what they do. They don't want to incur the court's disapproval. They don't want to be seen to be putting through more cases which might fail. They really don't like. They like their percentages. They like to be able to say that 80% of the cases they put through are successful. I've no idea why they cling on to statistics like that. It means absolutely nothing. You put it through if you think there are grounds and if you think that the Court of Appeal should do it, not what they actually will do when there's huge criticisms about the judgments that come out of the Court of Appeal.
So at this stage, how hopeful are you that you'll be able to overturn Alex's conviction?
I will overturn it one day. I'm not confident that it will happen before he's released.
Okay. And where do you get your such such confidence from?
It's just too much of an injustice. I can't let it go. I will be an 89-year-old woman, like, still doing it. So, yeah.
The process of trying to overturn Alex's conviction has had a huge impact on Charlotte's life.
It's ripped my family apart, clinging onto sanity with my fingertips. So that's a bad side. It's, you know, taken away. Alex has had to live his whole life again inside. He'd done the first 20 on the outside, second 19 on the inside, if he gets out at the first opportunity. So everything that comes with that, a complete loss of faith in our government, even though it's the Court of Appeal that have done it. I just feel like we have a lot of support from MPs and front benchers, but there's just not enough support. And you often hear from MPs that, it's not a vote spinner, it's not a vote winner, this argument. And we get a lot of support, we get some excellent MPs, but it's not enough. So yeah, I've lost faith in really the government and the running of the country.
Charlotte says that despite having a law degree before this all took place, the process of trying to overturn her brother's conviction has completely transformed her view of the justice system.
My impression of the justice system at that time was probably by and large the same as what the general public's was. I think I had a real faith that our justice system was one of the best in the world. Something that other countries kind of looked to something that they would aspire to be like. But obviously, now I don't believe that.
Like many others impacted by joint enterprise sentences, Alex and his family are hoping for reform to the law, under which young people in particular can be imprisoned for crimes their associates commit. Alex has spent almost his entire 20s in prison and still has his 30s to serve. He is in his second year of an Open University degree in sports, fitness and coaching, and is trying to turn around his life for his daughter who visits him in prison. He is currently appealing to the UN's Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in the hope that they intervene with his case and appeal directly to the government. His family hope that this application will successfully argue that the UK has discriminated against him by not taking his autism into account. But for now, he remains locked away. In the next episode, we look at the case of the Manchester 10 and why they were jailed for messages sent in a group chat.
What happens in these cases, whether joint enterprise or conspiracy style cases, is that when it is black boys in the dock, the gang narrative is much more likely to be applied to them than if it was their white peers.
This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.